Hi, welcome. The hour of 12 upon us. Just wanted to say welcome. Thanks you everybody for being here and spending some time on a beautiful day in Sandpoint. This is stop two for us or me. This was had started out to be Jim Woodward, myself, and Cornell Razor. Cornell Razor joined us up in Bonners, and he sent me a text message, said something came up and he can't finish here. But anyway, so and Jim Woodward's aunt, Bev, can talk about Jim's, this is getting pretty loud, situation. But anyway, he had a accident yesterday, not him, but his son, but I'll let Bev tell you about that.
So Jim's very sad to not be here, and he would be so pleased to see all these people. His 26-year-old son, him and Brenda's 26-year-old son, had a work injury yesterday where a piece of corrugated sheet pile fell on him, and he has fractured lumbar spine and sacrum, and apparently a fractured sacrum is not something you normally operate on, but this one needed operated on, so the medical field in the entire Pacific Northwest said the best place for him is Harborview. So we all know Jim loves to fly in airplanes. He got an airplane ride yesterday. And Avery and Jim are at Harborview. Brenda drove over this morning. Avery's surgery will be on Monday. And he had no head injury. Thank you, Lord. And he has no paralysis issues, spinal problems. So, and his spirits are very, very good. He's just going to have a slow recovery. And Tuesday is Jim's birthday. He always gets really bored. So if everyone in here can text him happy birthday and have his phone go off in the hospital, that would be great. And I know what Jim was going to cover today was just a little tutorial on how legislation works. He has put on his webpage a page called In Session, and it's like the TV guide to As the Rotunda Turns. And it's all linked to the Idaho State Legislature site, but it's a very easy menu to follow and see who the committees are, what their agendas are, actually log in and watch the committees, and also stream in if you want to watch the Senate or the House on the floor. So Mark may or may not reference that. If we're talking about a particular bill, we'll be able to just pull it up there. And who's on that committee, we can pull that up. But I'll turn it over to Mark for more interesting things.
Thank you. Thanks, Bev. Okay, my plan is to give a short summary of kind of where we are to date, and then I'm very willing and open to answer lots of questions, so we have a nice amount of time. So I'll walk you through it. If once you start having questions, then let's have at it. We must have had 30 or 40 questions up in Bonners, so, and that's helpful too, because it's a good way to for everybody to communicate and pass. Hi, Rob. To start with, the session really started in the fall. We've had three representatives leave, and all of those were, you could say, in leadership. Wendy Horman was the co-chair of JFAC, so she was the House leader in JFAC. There's 10 people on that committee. Andrus, I can't remember his first name, was the chair of Agriculture Affairs. So that's an important committee in our state, obviously, for any place that has ag, and not so much in Bonner County, but certainly Boundary County, that's a real important issue. And then Lance Clow resigned, and Lance was the business chair of the House. So all those chairman spots, and we can talk, we'll kind of walk our way into that, are really important, but it also means that other people come in, take over as chairs, and then people get filtered into those different committees to fill those other seats. So that started the House stuff in the fall. So we had a shakeup of the committees. I didn't get moved from any of my committees, but for instance, Cornell Razor moved from House Health and Welfare over to Tax and Rev. So in all of those votes, the way our bill system works are really critical, because that's the makeup of the committee. Every bill has to get out of a committee hearing before it could actually get to the floor. So that the makeup of everyone is really mission critical. So that said, and then especially with JFAC, with Wendy Horman leaving, the House Speaker appointed a guy named Josh Tanner to be the chair, and now he speaks for the House on JFAC. There's 9 other people on JFAC with him, and that's a pretty powerful position, and he's a relatively new legislator. So it's interesting to see. He has a completely different way of dealing with things and talking with people than Wendy Horman did. So it's just you have to adapt all of that for us. So also in the fall, we started getting we learned what our business community was doing with their monthly reports on taxation, and also what they were paying for their quarterlies. The revenues came down considerably from what was predicted, and there was quite a bit of concern that we would have enough money to pay our bills, that the state was really in some financial trouble. I'm happy to say in December that's changed, and since we've been around, in and around the Capitol from December until now, we've really learned a lot about what's going on with all our everything from federal tax conformity and then our own state revenue and spending. So we've made some changes, I'm happy to, and I'll talk about all those. But just in general, there's been a lot of different changes in the last few months, some good and some just things that we're going to need to adjust to. So that's kind of the uncertain part. We are back in business. We've been in the Capitol for 3 weeks now. Bills have started to be introduced. We're starting to make some decisions as a body on the amount of revenue that we think we're going to bring in this year and next year, and starting to look at balancing our budget for this year and next year. And after all, that's the number one priority for the legislature. So those things are starting to come together where we can make some decisions and we can know really how things are going to go. There, you may hear about it in the papers and other places, that Idaho has a spending problem from some. And you also may hear that we have a revenue problem. And we could debate a lot of that. I have some statistics with me to kind of address those that are from the State Department of Finance. So we can discuss that if for some reason you want to talk to me, or talk to me afterwards if you like to get some of that information. But another way to look at it is a question is, do we have a cash flow issue? And I'll explain. When the big beautiful bill, bless you, was passed in 4th of July, I think, of 2025, that started some federal tax rules and laws that have changed things for our business community. And it allows, that bill, there's 39 tax provisions in it. It started it started a trend in our business community. We start asking, when do businesses start taking advantage of the federal tax rules? And a lot of our people in our business community started applying that immediately. They can do that for the Fed. For the state part, we as the state have to adopt those changes, and we call it conformity. So the question is, will the state adopt all of the big beautiful bill provisions? And the answer is to be continued, because on Monday there's a bill that will be introduced to House Tax and Rev of a plan on how we would accept the federal big beautiful bill and how to apply it. It's not just about accepting it going forward, because the big beautiful bill takes in all of 2025, and 2025 is in our rearview mirrors now. It's a matter of how you adopt that and how you deal with it. So it's kind of a moving target. So we're doing our best to get all the numbers on that so we can make good decisions on that, good financial decisions. So that said, I can at least tell you the rough spot on the bill that we're going to hear on the tax and rev will hear Monday is, it looks like the state will adopt all of the individual income tax provisions of the Big Beautiful Bill. There's a little bit for seniors in that. I don't know that much about that part. It will adopt the no tax on overtime, no tax on tips, and it will adopt the auto loan interest. You can write that off. But I think there's some wage limits on that. But the state of Idaho will adopt those issues. And if you're wondering, well, why exactly do we have to jump into that if we have a revenue issue? The belief is those provisions are in place for 4 years, 25, 26, 27, and 28. If the legislature said we're not going to do it until 26, we've essentially cut out 25% of what's possible. The other part of it is people have made lots of decisions in 2025, and we would be back in, you know, putting them in a bad spot. So it appears the bill is set to where we would accept all of the individual stuff for all 4 years. The question is really is the business part of it. The business part of it, I'll just make this real short, is a lot of it is it boils down to how to write off R&D. It used to be R&D, research and development. Now it's research and experimentation. But how to write that off. And the Big Beautiful Bill allows that to go back to 2022. So what the belief is, and there's a lot of people that have done some work on it, is that most of the business community in Idaho has already taken that 22, 23, 24, and done those write-offs in their submittals this year, up to date, so the last 6 months. So we think the term used is that's washed through the system already. So when we had the few months of downturn in commercial tax revenues that we were looking at, we looked at that and we said, well, boy, the numbers are way down. What's happened to our business? Well, a lot of the businesses elected to take those write-offs immediately. So how to do that? So a lot of that impact from the Big Beautiful Bill for our business write-offs has already happened. The state's already experienced. The belief is that about 80% of that hit has already happened. How much is it? The expectation is that it's about $155 million on of revenue that we won't get. So we're adapting the state budget to that right now to make sure that all will work. The good news is December, and then I think today's the last day of January, we will soon hear how our revenue is for January as well. But it looks like December was much higher, so those hits have already been taken. So we're hopeful that enters in my phrase, the cash flow. There's a certain belief that a lot of this issue with the Big Beautiful Bill, it's really a cash flow thing that in 27 and 28 moving forward, it's not a continuous problem like it is for 25. So we're going to continue to work on all those details. Sean's in the second row here. She knows all about JFAC. But so we're getting the best information that we have, and we'll continue to try and make the best decisions that we have. But it's a moving target between new people, new leadership, and a lot of different facts that are flying around the room. So anyway, that's enough on our tax revenue issue. As far as the state goes, in the fall, the state governor issued a directive to all the departments for a 3% holdback on their budgets, and for the most part, other than K through 12 education, that has happened. And as a result of that, there were also some health and welfare cuts. Probably most noticeable for a number of people in the community is the health and welfare decided to hold back about $22 million for spending for behavioral health. What's that mean? There's about six programs that were affected, and those six programs, for the most part, have all been highlighted by our Sheriff's Association across the state, chiefs of police, that while we may be saving $22 million by not funding those programs, it may very well turn out that we end up costing our communities $100 to $150 million in costs. So there's a number of us, me included, that are having quite a few meetings at the Capitol right now trying to figure out how do we deal with that? Do we just live with that, or do we try and figure out how we deal with that $22 million and see if there's a way to cover that so we don't have the behavioral health problems in our community and not address them? So we're looking at that. I don't have a solution. I have not started a draft bill on that, full disclosure. But a lot of us are working vigorously to figure that issue out. When I talked to our sheriffs, I talked to Travis Stoley up in Bonners last night at length about it, and then I talked to ISP. Everybody's concerned because if we don't take care of our behavioral health issues, we fill up hospital beds, which are expensive, takes up space, fill up jail cells. There's other problems that come with behavioral health issues. So we don't want that from a public safety perspective. So we're trying to take care of that issue, but it's a work in progress. So. Now the 3% is supposed to be this fiscal, which is 2026, and then 27 as well. And then last Monday, the governor issued a directive to the departments to provide a 1% and separately a 2% cut to their budgets, which is extremely tough if you think about it, because fiscal year ends at the end of June, right? So they've got to cut 1% to 2% of their budget from a budget that's already 50% gone or more. So those are in the works. When that was, except for health and welfare and except for K through 12 education. Wednesday, they added K through 12 and health and welfare. The other part of that directive is they need to say, what do they think will be the consequences of these different cuts? So like I said, we're working on the revenue part, trying to adjust our saddlebags, if you will, on revenue. But having that information, I would say, is a good thing to know what all the numbers are and if, in fact, we're going to do that. Interestingly enough, Thursday, just a couple days ago, our superintendent of education, Debbie Critchfield, essentially set the message out and said, well, our K through 12 budget, we're not going to submit 1% or 2% cuts. So there. And the secretary, anyway, she's an elected official statewide. And I think the same thing has happened with our Secretary of State, and I think the same thing has happened with our AG. So all three of those are elected officials, and all three have stood pat. So we will see what happens with them with their JFAC budgets too. And you know, that's to be continued. So I try not to delve too much. I'm curious, but not judgmental. I try and learn all I can, and I want to vote on all those things that I can vote on. But in the interim, you can get lost in the noise of the Capitol with all the other bills that are not in your lane. So I try and listen and understand it, but there's a time and a place for how you vote. So for those situations, I'm just trying to inform everybody what's going on. Yes, sir.
Quick question. So how can those departments be compelled to submit their budgets? Is there a mechanism for like the governor's office to compel them to do that? I mean, what you're describing is them like resisting the cuts.
Oh, those three?
I just want to clarify, the governor didn't ask for those.
Oh, it's JFAC.
Thank
you for that, Sean. The governor asked for that. Ultimately, the JFAC co-chairs asked for those cuts. As far as a mechanism of enforcement, the Department of Education still has to get their budget approved through JFAC. So I'm not sure what consequences, if any, they have immediately. But it's a battle that we'll have to just watch it play out. So, okay. The governor obviously has an association with Ed, Secretary of State, and the AG's office, and they'll have to work all those funding issues out. But it ultimately, it's a JFAC vote on all their budgets.
So it's going to be politics.
Yep. Yes, it will. Yeah. Thanks for that. That's a good summary. Thanks, Zach. So all that said, it feels like now we can start to get to work on bills. I think we have, somebody said earlier that we have 75 to 100 bills that are in the queue, meaning they've started to be introduced. So we're going to get to work on that too, because usually it's a parallel track. The JFAC does all the appropriation bills, which is usually over 100, and they'll work on that part. And then the bill side of the house, that when people like me are bringing a different bill for their area, those tracks run parallel. And probably another 3 or 4 weeks from now, we'll be running appropriation bills on the floor for approval, and the same with bills that may affect health and welfare, may affect somebody's district, but all that will go at the same time. Towards the end, we do more appropriation bills than we do personal bills or bills from districts. So so that kind of catches you up to date. Yet last week I actually introduced a couple of two different what's called RSs, which is the beginning of a bill. Those were on Thursday, and started those out, one in business and one in resources. So I have plenty of other bills, but I've written a couple things and more than a couple things in the paper. Josh has covered some of it, Carolyn too. But I just want to report on one bill that I brought, and that's the health of the mother exception for our abortion statute. I brought that as a RS, brought it to the chair of House State Affairs, and so far he will not hear it. So that's the power of the chairs, that a lot of people don't, you've just maybe probably never heard about it. So now I've taken that whole issue and literally plopped it on the Speaker of the House's desk or chair and said, okay, I need to meet with you about this. I don't think that's a good choice for our area, but that's how our system works. And I will continue to work on it and push on that issue, but that's how the system works. It surprisingly, sometimes it's not a democracy when it comes to hearing and listening to every bill that's out there. So here we are. But that one right now is stuck, if you will. So anyway, we did that. I have a sheet here. Besides following up on Jim Woodward's birthday, I'm happy to add lots of questions for all of you if you have it. Let me think. And then last night, I think I'll go through some local issues here, and then we can open it up to whatever questions you may have. Last night we had a meeting up in Bonner's Ferry at the high school. It was a 4-hour open meeting, just like we've had in Sagal when we talked about moving the highway around and going through some farmers' fields. We went up there and talked to the residents up there and asked them what their suggestions are for Highway 95, primarily from Sandpoint on up to the Canadian border. We got some really good feedback. The downside is, because of all of our different budget issues this fiscal year, the ITD funding for highway and bridge improvements has essentially been stopped if the projects have not been started already. So what's it look like for next fiscal year? I'm not sure that we have the revenue numbers yet, so I can't tell you that. I don't have a crystal ball on that. But everything from signs to striping to just enforcement, all those different things came up last night. So it was helpful for ITD to hear it. ISP was there and listened. And there was a lot of good comments from the residents on all of those things. I took quite a few notes on things that we can follow up. We have the money for signage and striping and all that. It's putting in a new MacArthur bypass that gets expensive. So we'll have to wait and see how we do with all of those. But we had a good conversation last night about that. And then nearby, or I'll just call it the local issues that I think are really important for us, and I take near and dear to me. The women's health thing I already talked to you about. our rural health care system is really struggling right now. Many of you probably know it. It's not just the sign of the times that not everyone's, you know, able to pay all their bills, but the behavioral health issue. If we don't take care of some of our behavioral health issues and that those cases end up in the ER, it's an expensive way to treat behavioral health issues. If some of those issues, the behavioral health problems, find their way into the law enforcement realm, it's expensive to jail all those people, you know, anybody that may be involved in that or caught up in it. We already have our jails are pretty much at capacity. Truth is, there's 1,200 state inmates that are jailed in county jails across the state. And the state doesn't pay exactly how much it costs the jails every day. So there's a funding issue there as well. So there's lots of sobering things to work on, but our rural health issue is certainly one of them. We all know we've closed the labor and delivery unit here in Sandpoint. We know we've had some doctors move out of town. So I'm very concerned about all of those issues. So we're trying to figure out what we can do to help and better fund our rural health care. Part of the big, beautiful bill, I think the state of Idaho is supposed to get about $900 million to help rural health care. They just organized that committee last week, and I'll just say it's to be determined how that's all going to work out. So there's five people from the House on the committee. I sat in the audience and watched, and I'm real concerned how we're going to figure out how to use that money for the betterment of the rural areas in Idaho. I'll just leave it at that. It's something that I'm going to have to follow very closely. Yes, ma'am.
Are they all the committee members, those type of people, are they all from the South?
No, we actually have one that's from the North, Jordan Redman. He's from Hayden. He's the chair of the committee. And then, Dustin Manwaring is from Pocatello. And then the other three are from Treasure Valley. So I personally have some issues because those aren't exactly rural areas, but that's just me. So anyway, I need to take that up with the speaker too. I have a few things to talk to the speaker about. So I think we need to have somebody from, I don't care if it's from Orofino or, you know, if he doesn't like my haircut, it may not be from Sandpoint, but it ought to be from some place that has some experience with the rural healthcare situation. Have it be somebody from Salmon. But I think they would be able to have a better taste for what's going on. Yes, ma'am.
That was my question. Oh. Is there anybody from a rural area?
Yeah. Eagle. Right, enough said. Eagle, Meridian, Boise. Those aren't sounding rural to you, are they? So yeah, and Hayden has KMC, so that's a completely different look than here. So anyway, I try not to be sarcastic, cynical, skeptical. I'll just stick to being curious and following up, okay? Another issue is Lake Ponderay. That's a continued issue. I think this week the report is finally out for the economic impact. I think that should be released. I got a rough draft of it yesterday that I can look at. It's pretty clear if the lake was managed differently, it appears our community would be more in the black by like $20 to $25 million a year. So it makes sense to manage the lake level differently. But now we just need to continue to convince the Corps of Engineers and others that that's really what needs to happen. But having an economic impact report, I think it will be really helpful. U of I did it. We paid part of it. But I think having some math is important. Last week, I handed off the information and questions to IWERI, which is the Idaho U of I department, Idaho Water Research Institute, and they're now going to look at what the lake level does to our water recharge and if it's really the current operating plan is the best use of that water. If you think about it, we have about 18 million acre feet that pass through this place, goes right past us. And we can store about 1 million acre feet or 1.3. But what we do with the rest of it is up in the air. And right now the Corps of Engineers and the Bonneville Power Authority, they have their own mindset on how they should manage that. And many of us, me included for sure, think that should be different. That if we kept the lake higher, we'd have better water recharge. The Rathdrum Aquifer, for instance, would have a much better water supply. That helps Idaho, ultimately even helps Washington. And then how we manage our water flow for power too. So we're doing a lot of study on that. So I call that the science part. So that's started now too. So we continue to do these things. So it's not just Idaho, just some representative from North Idaho complaining at the Corps of Engineers meetings or whatever. Actually, our governor's on board with it. So now we can, as a state, say, no, we've researched this. Here's the math, here's the science. Our communities up here deserve a better shake than they're getting. And anyway, I'm hopeful the federal, our federal government will continue to make improvements that will help our lake level situation. They passed language, appropriation language, just like last week to direct the Corps to get to work on the dam and get it fixed and then listen to us for a better operating plan. So I'm optimistic and hopeful. I'm told by the people that have worked here on the same issue for 20 years that we're farther along today than in their 20-year, 20-year fight with this. So it may seem like a long way, and it sure does for me too. But it helps me when I get a few people that have been at this battle for a long time telling me, hey, we're making progress, and it's better than it was, and we're going to do this. We're going to get our lake level better, improved, that will help our whole community, help our wildlife, and help our, just our economy too. So, and make better use of the water too. If the water recharge is important.
Question on the lake.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm not up to speed on what has transpired about the gates. I know you said they're going to get to work on it, but yeah. Have they come up with any solution?
Well, they actually did I hate to use the word, but I will. They did a Band-Aid repair on one of the gates that they said was damaged, and that's back in service. It was rather expensive. But now we need to get the Corps. They've done all these specifications on building more gates, but it looks like now they'll go out to bid in spring and to get bid. What we were told initially they would replace these 10 gates one at a time, once every 6 months or whatever. As I understand it, that now even the Corps has said, well, maybe we could do them two or three or four at a time, which makes a lot better sense for many of us. So there's 10. So all those are, everything's important really for that. Talked about behavioral health, talked about Highway 95. And then speaking of the lake, we had a DOGE committee. Maybe some of you have heard of that. I actually went in October. It's not really a laughing matter. There's people that take it very serious. Me too, as far as being efficient and effective and smart about how we spend money and how we operate our state. So that is very important. But our Lakes Commission that essentially represents us with all of our water issues, that was on the chopping block. So I went on in October, spoke out again about the importance of it for our area, and at least for now, and I saw the agenda for the upcoming summer, and the Lakes Commission is not on that list. So I'm hopeful that we can keep it off the list, but I'll go to every meeting I can to save that. So I think it's really important for us to do that. And the last thing I'll talk about is this week we introduced a bill that that may impact some people in our room. IDL does a lot of our firefighting, right? They were here for the Sunset Fire. They don't do our structure firefighting, but they do all the wildland work. They've been underfunded for years. I think they charge 60 cents an acre on our tax bills. It's not too much. And for years, they've had a $40 per structure fee that they've had in code that they could charge. And anyway, we recently had a bill come through the House Resources Committee that would allow that fee to increase as much as up to $100. but it still hasn't, it needs to go through our land board, and it's not a carte blanche, everything will go to $100. But it was believed that that would be a reasonable fee increase in some cases. So we'll have to see ultimately the final bill, and I think we've moved it off out of the House Resources Committee, and now it'll go to the floor for a vote. So that's an option. Yes, ma'am.
What number is that?
I don't know. So maybe we could talk about that real quick. Let me get this next question, and I'll go back to you.
Yes? I was just wondering, was that per house or per acre?
It's a per house. The as far as I know, the 60 cents per acre remains. And it was just that they said, hey, we need to figure out, I mean, they showed us a map, and there's thousands of homes built across our state that they are really in a position, because there a lot of those are outside fire districts. So IDL really is the only firefighting entity out there, and they're like, can you help us out a little bit here? So that's the comment. And I think, I've been told, I try and study the insurance issue as really close, but for a number of these areas, they're getting non-renewal letters. I guess I can back and talk to that about as well. But they're getting a non-renewal letter because they don't have insurance or don't have a fire district around. So having an IDL resource may allow some of those people to keep their insurance. So it's important for most people. So that's sometimes the cost of doing business. Ma'am, back to you. I think Andy might be able to turn we can turn on and show you how to look at things on the House bills. Yes.
511,
Sean says. We can show them on the website too. Thanks, Sean. Yes, ma'am.
Question while we're waiting.
Yeah.
Thanks for all you're doing for us.
So, thanks. It's humbling to be here, okay? And I'm carrying the show today, so this is interesting.
How do we, as a community, if there is a way, become more autonomous from the state controlling what we do? The short-term rental, of course, is recent, and I just saw that they are now doing the NDOs for the counties and the cities. And in Idaho, the non-discrimination ordinances, there's a bill to stop us from having those across the state as well. What do we do? How do we fight that?
Talk to your representatives and vote against some of these bills, for one. I'm not aware of the two bills that you've talked about. I can start getting into those. I've been starting a bunch of other bills, and I look at Sean and go, once you get into the mill, there's a number of things that representatives, I think, have to do. You need to follow all the bills that are being one, listen to your district. The second one is you need to follow the bills that are in play. You have to consider, and if you're going to run bills on your own, and then you have to kind of read the room and then understand the appropriation. So there's a lot of different issues to follow. And so far, I've not started digging into the website to find all these bills that may or may not get a hearing. Let's just say, for instance, as an example, the women's health bill, it's not made it up because it hasn't had a hearing. So, but if it had a hearing, I could easily be a legislator somewhere else in the state and spent time reading that, maybe even contacted me and said, hey, can you explain this, this, and this? But if it's not going to get a hearing, it's not going to go far, and you could make the argument, why waste your time? So there's a time and a place to engage as a representative in all these different issues. Number one, go back to listen to your community, that's why we're here, and then to follow along. But to just follow the website and early on, sometimes we can get spun up on bills that will never really see the light of day. So you got to kind of have some judgment on that. Does that answer your question?
No, but I guess there is.
Oh, well, the answer is you let your representatives, once the bill is in play, gets printed, to reach out to your representatives and let them know how you feel. We talked about this in Bonner's. Please don't get involved at this point in the game, I get 100 to 300 emails a day. So to see the emails that you get that are what many of us call point and click, and they could be important issues, and they're people that feel that that's really important to send that message. But it's the same message. And you don't even, lots of times you don't even know where they're from. So I would suggest if you want to reach out to me, I'll try and read every email that I get.
I did this morning.
But, okay. Send a message to, you know, to me. Put your zip code or whatever in the byline so you can see right away, hey, this is from home. And I have to respond to this. So or read it and listen to, you know, understand it. So that's how. Just encourage your representatives that and let them know what you think. I'd rather get an email. It's faster to sit down and get all your voicemails and, you know, download all that. It's just email is pretty quick. So thank you. And about the insurance. Oh, okay. Here's what you will see when you look at. Can you back up a couple of clicks? Actually, just the sheet where you pulled it. Yeah, how you got to it, Bev. There you go, one more. Okay, the legislative website, you'll find these are the bills by number, and this is all the House side. You know, we started at 489, I think we're way above 450 now, or 550, and this just happens to be the list of bills. When they're, you can look to the right and you can see where they're at, you know, some of the bills you can see they're printing. So they haven't even, you may not even be able to read them yet. So, but as you know, House State Affairs, let's see, I'm looking here at, well, there's a boating, 548, boat safety enforcement. That's going to House State Affairs, but they haven't had the hearing yet. So if you're interested, you can click on that. Then you can click on House State Affairs and look at their agenda. And then you should be able to find out when they're going to actually hear it. And through technology, you could actually zoom in and you can listen to the hearing. And for the most part, other than I think Tax and Rev, you can actually testify online. It's up to the chairman right now if they'll take on remote testimony or not. But so you can actually be involved in all this stuff from here. Yes, ma'am.
These chair people have. It sounds like they have a lot of power.
Mm-hmm. They do.
So if you write a bill and it hasn't been approved by the chair people,
right.
how do we find out if we like what you wrote? How do we find out who the chairperson is that we can lobby that person to have them decide to push it forward?
Okay, you asked a few questions. I'll try and get every bit of it. Number one, you can... When a bill's in draft form, it's the property of whoever's writing it. It's their property. It's intellectual property, you could say. I have a hard time putting me with intellectual. But anyway, that's my property for a bit. If you email me, I'll just send you the bill that I wrote. I'd be happy to share it with you. But there's a little bit of a strategy issue. Do you spread your bill out to the world to let them know before you've actually, if you've worked in a military environment, you know, fire service maybe, you try and go through all the chain of command and going right to your immediate boss, if you will, like a chairman, that usually is more acceptable than trying to get 100 people from your community to kind of ambush the guy before he even knows that I'm bringing a bill. So what I've done is just kind of systematically walk through all the chairs. Now my case is really with the Speaker of the House. That's kind of how this women's health bill has gone. But ultimately, whatever committee that would be heard in, so in this case it would be House State Affairs, you'd be able to go to the chair, send an email to the chair of the House State Affairs Committee, that would be Brent Crane. You could send him an email. Hi, I'm Mrs. Sandpoint, and it's really important to me for you to hold a hearing for our representative's bill on this. And just wanted you to know, you know, you could talk about our healthcare system, you could, you know, just your opinion, and then let them know that this is, you know, you could use your 83864 zip code or whatever just to identify so he would know what's going on. But I've not, my own belief is I shouldn't release the dragons yet. because I want to make sure I go through all the chain, because that sometimes will just rattle people, and I want to be respectful of the chairs and respectful of the speaker. We may get angry, we may get frustrated, but there's a way to work through the building and not get as much collateral damage. So that's what I'm hopeful of. Yes, ma'am.
So at what point can you let us know that we need to lobby somebody?
You'd probably read it in the paper when I write my next article for the Bee, which is next Sunday, a week from tomorrow. I'll probably report on that bill and kind of where it's at. Because a lot of people have been very interested in it. Certainly it's important to our community. So I'll report on that a week from now.
And you'll tell us who to write to.
Yeah, it'll be up to you guys.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
So, and then we talked for a minute about insurance, and we'll get into Aunt Bev's issue in a minute here. I also started a bill last Thursday, and something that we've written about, and what it does is it extends the runway for people that get a letter of non-renewal for their property insurance. So instead of having 30 days, you'd have 60 days to deal with it. I know you should, so what? But when a number of people get these letters, there are some that want to negotiate with their insurance company and say, what's it going to take for me to keep my insurance? It's amazing. It is a fact. A lot of people have a lot of loyalty to their insurance carriers. Some of them have had Allstate Insurance for 15 or 20 years, and they may insurance their whole world, and one property is going to get a letter of non-renewal. So that bill just extends that time from 30 to 60 days. So if they can negotiate and it comes out, or the other issue is, if you got that letter and you were a week into this 30-day period because you were out of town or for whatever reason, time's important. So it gives options for people to find a new carrier. And there's another piece of this is, as far as information-wise, a lot of people in our state, and I'm not one that's really in the know about it, we have a Department of Insurance. There's insurance carriers and insurance companies are all regulated by our Department of Insurance. So if we have an issue with an insurance carrier, you can email the state or call the state. They have people that will work with you on carriers. They also have a list of all of our agents in town. We're blessed. We have lots of insurance agents here in our town. And if you're not happy with your carrier or whatever, or you get a letter of non-renewal, then there's a way to deal with that. But 60 days just gives everybody a little longer runway. So we've got another bill coming up with some transparency issues for the insurance companies. But first things first, we just wanted to get some more time for people. So. Yes, ma'am.
Have a balanced budget, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so I'm very confused as to why we're actually in this position. My understanding is that every Idahoan, I think the average was, they got $250 back last year. So how much did that $250 equal compared to where our shortfall is? If we had not been given that money back, where would we be right now? I think that there's a lack of accountability with our legislature and with our governor about their role in this situation. They've patted themselves on the back when the governor did his State of the Union address. And I'm really tired of hearing this, it's an issue with the feds and whatever. The legislature is obligated to handle money correctly, and they're not doing it. They're not funding education correctly. They're not funding mental health, and yada, and on and on and on. And so my concern is that, okay, we're looking forward, but we also have to look backward to what's been done.
Okay, let me see if I can answer that. I don't know what the number is, the 250 across the board for taxpayers, and if that's really the shortfall. I think we started doing numbers on all of our budget situation in the fall and said we were short on revenue, so they started making corrections. Now December, the money's starting to come back in because of different corrections with the big, beautiful bill. I own my vote. I thought that we, based on what I understood, I thought we could withstand that that tax cut last year. I own it. You want to tell me I'm wrong? I accept that. Thank you for that. But there's a confluence of issues. I don't think anybody anticipated the big, beautiful bill costing $150 million for revenue. So that wasn't something, that's something that we missed. So we'll own it. I can't tell you how many meetings I've already been to this session trying to get a better handle on all of our state finances. Okay, so there's also quite a bit of conversation going on right now about what the state, because we have reserves and how to use that. And I go back to what I said was, do we have a revenue issue, a spending issue, or do we have a cash flow issue where we had to get that process go through the capital and go through all of our spending? So the question is, if we have $1.5 billion in reserves, all of your money, by the way, mine too, then maybe the time is the time and the place that we would use some of that reserve in the short term and then have it right in the bill that we would replace that money in the fall or a year from now when revenues do flatten out and we do have a better understanding of what's gone on with our spending and our revenue. So, but just to be clear, I voted for House Bill 40, okay, so I own that.
Yeah. And I know that legislatures in the past, and Sean has served on JFAC, we did not run into this problem. And I think that we have a legislature that needs to be able to look outside themselves, and that means looking at what's going on federally too, and also not anticipating that our economy is going to continue to grow when we are in the circumstances that we are in now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Aunt Bev, you wanted to show the website to where you can follow that along on? Yes, sir. Oh, okay, go ahead.
Hey there, I walked in a little bit late, so if I'm asking a question that's already been asked, I apologize to everybody. Congressman Fulcher has already, he's the latest to throw out language regarding transferring public lands back to the state. I'd be curious to hear if you support that type of language when these legislative proposals come up.
When I started looking into this a few years ago, the state doesn't have, when I looked at it and I had a number of conversations with IDL as far as protecting, doing the fire protection, all that, we don't have the resources to accept it without changing things the way they are. I don't like the idea of having public lands go back and be sold off. So I don't support that. I don't think the people in our room do. I think we value and love our public lands. So I don't know what it looks like for our federal government to transfer lands here, just to say, oh, you got Idaho, you got it. And one catastrophic fire comes in and all of a sudden we're $30 to $40 million in firefighting costs for one season. That's a big pill to swallow. So I'm real leery of, you know, yeah, we can take it on, but then what? How do we support that, the maintenance of it, and how do we deal with it? And I've not heard anybody with a solid plan on moving forward how that works. I am part of the Shared Stewardship Committee here in our state, and I do think that we could manage our forests better than have been done in the Forest Service realm. The people in Boundary County can't wait to start doing a little more logging because that's what a lot of their economy is. But we have to do it responsibly, and having the state involved in it I think is a great thing. But just giving us the keys to the car and without any funding to take care of it. And I think there is, and I kind of listened to you, I think down deep we're saying, so then does it just get sold off? And I don't support that at all. I don't think that's right. I don't think it's good business, and I really don't think the people in our room want that to happen. So we're here in Idaho, I think. A lot of us are here because we do like the open spaces and we do like access to public land. So, did that answer your question? Like, probably longer than you needed, but. But I will throw this out. One thing that's really important for everybody, and Bev had it up here, and the bills keep coming up, is read the bill. And sometimes we just see a one or two sentence summary of what people think it really is. Read the bill and see, you know, what the fiscal impact is, or that's reported by the bill writer, and then try and forecast how it looks going forward. And sometimes that gives you also some insight into what's going on. So, yes, sir. You make a great point, sir, and that is IDL's issue, is that they have a direction, and IDL will say it not as an excuse, but they will just highlight the issue that Forest Service has a different mission. They have they're a multi-use area. So what matters to the Forest Service is, yes, management of the timber part, but they also manage for public access. They also manage for wildlife, scenic beauty, all these other things. The IDL people that I've spent time with have all said, if we had to manage our ground like the Forest Service manages their ground, we would have a much tougher go of it, because we just can't look at just timber production. We actually have to figure out all the other parts of this, the parks and rec part. So that's the challenge to all this. It's more than just a matter of us picking up some more ground. It's, what do we do with it? What's, you know, are we going to get it without strings? Or is somebody going to tell us, oh, by the way, you need to deal with your wildlife this way. You need to deal with, you know, the mining this way. And so the devil's in the details for that, for sure.
Okay. So public speaking makes me want to crawl in a hole and die. So just bear with me here.
I'm with you.
Yeah, I hate it. So my question is the rural health care, the bailout money, essentially. My concern is that there's such a short time limit to turn in that budget, right, to Dr. Oz, I think. My fear is that money is going to be spent on tech instead of staffing, infrastructure, equipment, doctors, things like that that matter to a hospital. So I just want to voice the concern that I'm afraid it's going to go all to putting new tech in as opposed to paying nurses and doctors. We've lost 35% of our OBGYNs in 2 years. We are 1,500 doctors short per capita in Idaho. I think that's like a kind of like a crisis. So I was just hoping that there's like a real hardcore vision on where this money is going and how it's being spent.
Okay, number one, the committee just started, okay. I went to the first meeting to listen in. I have concerns about the direction of the committee. Only time will tell about that. All of our representatives are gonna need to weigh in and let that committee know how important it is for us to have doctors and for us to have brick and mortar facilities that would take care of our patients. So I feel for you that way. I've heard the same thing, that some of that grant, the paperwork on the grants is that they're looking for more kiosks and iPads than they are looking for caregivers. I can't answer where the committee will go yet, because they've just started. I can say that many of us want to really be involved in this and see what we can do to direct those funds to where they will help our communities, especially our rural healthcare facilities. I think there's 27. So how are we going to apply that money and get some traction in our own community in a sustainable way, that we won't just spend that money for 4 or 5 years and not have anything better for the future after that? The nature of a grant, right, is to start something that can then be sustainable, not just temporary fees, not just staffing that will work for a couple of years and then goes away. So we've got a ways to go. I'm optimistic that at least there's some money that's there, but how it will be spent, I think that's going to take some real work to make sure it goes to the right place. So does that answer your question, ma'am? Thank you. Yeah, using grant money for staffing is usually not a good idea, because at some point the grant money falls out and goes away, and then you've got layoffs, or you've got an unfunded mandate that just doesn't work. So training people up, creating the environment that you can have some sustainable health care, that's what's really important. I mean, there's grants for the fire service. I'm looking at Merlin. There's grants that we do in the fire service that they do now. I'm not a fire service guy employed by them. But the tough part is that when you use grant money for staffing, when that grant money goes away, then can you maintain that staffing level? And in grants nowadays, a lot of them say that you have to have the ability to keep paying these guys or gals. So, and that's being responsible. So that'll be part of what we do with the rural health care issue, how to make that work. Yes, sir.
Mark, Josh Torres. Can you clarify what steps you are supporting to ensure that the federal immigration action respect constitutional protections, especially the rights of minorities, lawful gun owners, and citizens who are carrying a firearm legally?
That's not been a bill that I've had, that we've had in the Capitol. That has not been an issue on anything that I've had come before me.
Have you seen what's happened nationally?
Oh, I watch the news, yes.
Okay.
But I don't want to, you know, appear that I'm in an echo chamber and I'm not listening. I watch the news, I read, I follow everything the best I can. But so far, our state has not had any activity that way, that we would have a bill that I'd have to vote on or anything that's come in a committee that I sit on. So I don't want to turn my back to it, but on the other hand, that's not been an issue that's been for the state.
So will somebody being killed be a trigger? Or, like, I'm a minority man, Hispanic man, in Idaho, and I have a gun. I mean, I'm worried. It's concerning to me. So what can you do? What steps are you doing for me, a minority in this community, that's scared of these individuals that don't have any concern for people like me? I speak two languages, too.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, apparently not. You're not allowed to speak Spanish in this country, apparently now.
I haven't heard that yet. So
I'm just asking for help in your voice in the federal level for people like me in this community as well, because we literally just saw a man get shot standing up for a woman. And this is happening, and it's gonna bleed into our state. Yeah. And we're not gonna be prepared, because we're standing with them, not against them. And we're Idaho. We stand with our own state.
Right. So, point well taken. I'm just saying, I haven't worked on anything to deal with that. I'd be happy to listen, to talk with you. And here, if you have some ideas on things that should be done, I'll listen to you and see if there's something that we can do, something that I can work on. But for the time being, I have not worked on that. So, and Nora, I don't, as far as I know, no one in the Capitol is starting to work on that. But let me know. Let me know what you think and what solutions you think that you would recommend.
Greetings. Hi. It was very interesting how you are working on the budget. At least you're supposed to be. And it's just very common and very interesting that you gave away $50 million to private vouchers last year, for private school vouchers. And then, sure enough, we're $50 million in the hole in Idaho. And so what are you doing about that? Because it's just gonna get worse. They're gonna demand more money, and the children who are not gonna be accepted to these private schools are gonna be the special services, the handicapped, and many, many more. of course, until all of our money pays for more private schools to be built in Boise and Moscow and such. But public dollars should go to public schools, period.
Church, sectarian, religious society, or anything for religious purpose. And so that's going against the Constitution with Article 9, Section 1 and Section 5. How do they get away with going through any kind of shenanigans to get that in there? I don't get it. It's so obvious.
Let me think how I can walk through the answers. I voted against House Bill 93 throughout. Okay. But your question was really, I can't believe that it passed. House Bill 93 made it through the system. Okay, I voted against it. I argued on the floor about it. I debated against it, said I didn't think it was the right thing to do. If you follow committee stuff, it didn't even flow through the House Education Committee, the one that I sit on. It went through tax and rev. Okay, which is a different issue. So there's politics really are the answer. How did it make it? It made it through the political will of many that felt that's what we needed to do. I voted against it, so okay, I can your points are all well taken.
Yeah. Now you need to file a lawsuit because your state that you represent and your people here that you represent
are you're basically running on an unlawful, unconstitutional measure right now. And the Republicans always say, oh my God, we have a deficit and you created this deficit. So I know you voted against it, but what are you doing now? Today is now, and this is the time where you need to file a lawsuit against Raul Labrador because he will not stand up for our free and public constitutional rights.
The Supreme Court just heard arguments on January 23rd, a week ago yesterday, for that same issue, that House Bill 93 is unconstitutional. I don't think they've issued their answer yet, but they heard all the arguments last Friday. And there's articles in the paper about it, and you can hear what was said.
But these are slotted mechanisms of Raul and his boys. And the way that they leaned in their conversations and in their paragraphs that were released to the public was very, very, what should I say, very sympathetic to the private school vouchers.
Mm. Okay. So I'll wait to hear what the Supreme Court comes back with their verdict, and we can take an idea then and see if we're going to try and if they'll another lawsuit will be filed.
Until then, they should put everything on hold.
Well,
they have this little mechanism when you file your taxes now with the state. They're begging and pleading to people to sign up for these homeschool programs without any oversight.
Right.
These people can lock their children up in a closet for 17 years. And no one will be checking on them. There's no testing, there's no oversight, and we're funding this?
Yes, the majority in the Capitol voted to fund that system, yes. Yes, ma'am.
Tagging on what she said, and then I have another little thing. I just did a Zoom with Luke Mayville on the vouchers. And I learned something that many people here might not be aware of. I wasn't. I knew that families could file this application and they could get a tax credit. What I didn't know is if you don't owe that much in taxes, you will actually get a refund check for something you didn't send in. So if you think that $50 million is going to put us under families with four children, they can get $5,000 a child per year. If they have special ed, they can get $7,500, and they can get a check in the mail. They can live off of the money from our state in refund checks. So it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, that they are doing that. So that's just that part of that. The other part is, I hear all the time,
I hear all the time about these large groups that are outside of our state that are paying lobbyists to come and lobby and get certain bills pushed through our legislature. How do we deal with this? How can, as a state, as a people, as a legislature, can we write laws, can we that limits the amount of lobbyists or paid lobbyists that can affect our, the running of our state and the influence on our legislators? Because it just seems so crooked.
I think there's a bill that's been started, I heard a couple days ago, about out of state, I think something about if you're going to be a door knocker, you need to be a resident of Idaho, that so they would have to hire people from Idaho to do it. I think that will be, that's a start. I think they're going to eat that elephant one bite at a time and go after all the different pieces of how the lobbying works and how the door knocking works and how the you know, mailers work, and see what we can keep doing to make sure that's all from Idaho and it's not from out of state.
So.
Right.
It's like the short-term right. rental thing. There's a huge Airbnb group mm-hmm. that is pushing it, and they're not just Idaho Airbnb. They're using Idaho mm-hmm. as a testing ground. Mm-hmm. So how can we stop that from happening? It's not door knockers. It's
You can talk to the people that represent you. Okay, that's a good start. I'm right in front of you. I talked to one of the guys, the short-term rental people. I was in the state capitol. I bought my own lunch. But the guy came over and told me, you know, he's representing the private property rights. And I said, oh, really? Okay, well, who, you know, who and where? And it, well, it's just not right that people that have that live out of state that have houses here can't buy and sell and do what they want. And I, you know, and in the back of my mind, I go, okay, well, wait a minute. This has issues with, you know, housing costs and availability for rentals and all the rest. So, but they're in the Capitol. There's no guard gate that would stop them from coming in. But part of it is the elections have consequences across the state on how people vote. So I agree with you that it's a real concern. But there's some of that. And yes, there are dinners that are bought for legislators. Absolutely, that's the downside. The dark side is somebody's going to buy you a dinner. I don't know how much buying a dinner influences any of the legislators. I can't speak to that. I will say that you have lots of time to talk to people, and whether it's in the cafeteria, if it's coffee in the morning, whatever, but to have an exposure to listen to people is something that happens, and it's not always so dark and nefarious. But it, again, you need to sit and listen, and you know, when we can get away. And I mean, I know I can when I walk in the hallways, there are lobbyists in the building that don't talk to me. Okay, and I think it's for a reason, because they know I'm involved in education. Sean's smiling at me. But it's like there's must be like a yearbook before you even get there. And people know, you know, oh, you're from North Idaho. There's no reason for me to talk with you because you must feel a certain way. And sadly, that's good and bad. But anyway, it's a mixed bag.
How about limiting campaign donations to people, like from outside groups or from lobby groups?
You can go on the Secretary of State's website and see where all the money comes from. And I don't know what has or can be done about out-of-state money funneling into people, but you can certainly watch the candidates that get money from out of state and from different PACs. And it is true that we have Idaho PACs that call themselves Idaho and that really are funded from across the country. Okay, that's very true. So, but again, dig down and do the research on those. And it's up to you guys. You know, sadly, it's up to you to be able to decipher where that is and what goes on. So, yeah, that's how it works. So, thanks.
Hello. Since we're talking about money and all, what is the fiscal impact of your bill for women's health care that you have going?
The way I saw it, none. It would be a plus in our community if we could have more doctors. My bill really, my bill just clarifies what the judge in the Atkins case, you know, wrote down, which is that there is a place for the health of the mother exception, and it's in his decision that when I meet with OBGYNs across the state and lots of other medical groups. Lots of political action committees, they all supported it, saying that's what we really need is clarity. So it's not about opening the gates up for, you know, abortion as health, as birth control in any way. It's just, let's clarify things. Let's start this discussion, argument, conversation, by at least knowing what everything really means and how it all works. And that's what the bill that I had does. It's just, it's a clarification. I said it again and again. So anyway, to me, it really cuts both ways. The bill that I wrote, the criminalization is still there. It doesn't change the penalties. But interestingly enough, the doctors that I talked to, and I pointed it out and said, it doesn't change anything about that. And they said, we're good with that. We can follow the rules. But just make the rules clear. So that's what I was trying to do. Doesn't change the rules at all on abortion, but it makes sure that the doctors know that they can, and they're supported in statute to provide the medical care that the AG actually carries when he argues for our existing statute. The court found the same. It's like, good, write it down. And that's what I worked on. So.
Hi, Mark.
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks for being here today. First, on that other topic, I don't know what that bill would look like, but I think it'd be amazing to have a bill where only Idaho money can fund Idaho politics. I don't know what a bill like that looks like, but having no out-of-state money in our politics would be awesome. I have a question, and I know it's probably better for Jim, but I'll throw it at you. It's in regards to the housing committee that was formed that he was chair of or co-chair of that came here to Sandpoint this summer.
Yes, ma'am.
I was just curious if there's been sort of what the next step for that committee is and if there's been any bills that have been proposed in terms of housing and the need to look at more attainable housing in Idaho.
As I understand it, because I talked to Jim about that, and you're right, he was one of the chairs, I think, of that. That group is set, I don't know if it's any day now, but they will come out with a set of best practices. And that's the phrase that they use. It's not a directive to communities. You need to adopt these things. It's going to be the best practices from across the state of what works or what doesn't work for housing and how you can reduce the cost of housing for our residents, whether it's changing your building codes or accepting a little more growth, infill growth. But that's what they're going to come up with as a best practice. I don't know that there's any bills that have spun off of that yet. We'll wait and see. It's still early in the session.
Okay, great. I would, you know, one of the things, as you know, we did the first community land trust for this area in Priest River. And one of the things that we were working on is because there is a nonprofit tax exemption, typically for land. And in that case, the land and the house are decoupled. So we went in front of the county commissioners in order to get that tax relief on the land, because otherwise then you have to turn that over to those individuals who are purchasing the house, and it just becomes another added cost for them. So, you know, there is a code regarding, you know, revenue and taxation, and we were not allowed to, as a nonprofit, receive that benefit, much like we can on other land. And I think it's just due to some issues within this code that I'm going to hand to you that might be able to be reworked in order to, again, just, it's those little things in the toolbox that help people be able to afford a home and not to have excessive costs. So that might be a bill that might be interesting to you, and I'd be happy to help you work on it.
Absolutely. I'll talk to you as soon as we get done here. Thanks, Katie. Yes, Dave.
I'd like to step back to the issue which someone raised earlier about the, Pam Duquette spoke to it, that there's a bill in front of the legislature coming in that's going to be restraining cities or communities in Idaho from passing non-discrimination ordinances that clarify or affect or are different from in any way whatever the state code is. I read the bill, I read the state code to go through all of that to be clear on what the specifics are. And I know that there's a clear argument against that bill because it violates the sort of rights of the local communities to govern as they wish within a big picture. So it really takes away rights that the local community should have. But I think there's a bigger issue in the social dimension of that bill. I mean, we experienced it here in Sandpoint with the whole foo-foo around the allegations of a trans woman in the YMCA. And that's what triggered the city council here to withdraw the NDO, which was, I personally felt, was sort of pusillanimous, totally cowardly and disgusting. Now, my basis for feeling that way is that there's clear, I mean, I moved here from New York City, where we lived for 30 years, and part of my experience there was watching the gay community address the issue of HIV, the whole epidemic that came with that, and being hurt as a community themselves by the failure of the systems to support them and by the failure of the politics around the whole thing. And finally, they rebelled. And the clarity of the stance that they took was, we're queer, we're here, get used to it. People of various gender preferences have been around in humanity since its beginnings. And the science is real clear about the fact that there are actual differences. But the problem we have here is that there are personal preferences that people have. Some people are grossed out. They're disgusted. They don't want to even think about that. It's a horrible idea. That's so fine for them. They don't have to do it. They don't have to be, they can personally discriminate. But we shouldn't be doing that kind of discrimination as a matter of law, as a matter of legislative process. So I'm considering whether I can bring a bill. Say I'm a precinct committee man for the Beach Precinct. We sit on the Central Committee. Can we bring some of these issues from the Central Committee up to our congressional legislatures? Would you support taking some kind of a pressing issues from the Central Committee to take the issues to the Fulcher and Risch. And that would include even the questions the fellow earlier today had about how can we deal with this whole business with the ICE attacks. I'm saying, you know, can we work together to push for a more assertively against the extremists that are running things now?
Okay, Dave, we got it. First off, there's a time and a place for if you want to run a bill and get it through the Central Committee process, you're familiar with that. Typically, it goes through the Central Committee and then it'll go to a semi-annual meeting that goes with the Republican Party, because it's the Central Committee for the Republican Party, and there that bill would be introduced, and then they have a committee process that goes through it to see if they think it's worthy of adopting it as a platform. Next step is that someone from that body, the state GOP, would ask somebody in the House or the Senate to consider running some kind of legislation that way. So that's how that process works. I'm not familiar with anything from like the local BRCC going to the feds, going to Fulcher or Simpson or Crapo or Risch. So I'm not familiar with that process at all. If we as a Central Committee or the Central Committee or you as a PC want to bring something forward, go ahead and bring it and we'll see where it all goes. I'm not familiar with the bill that you mentioned. I have not delved into starting to look at the 50 or 60 bills that we have on our docket yet. But so I would just wait and see, you know, read the bill and see where we're at with it before I jump in and say, yeah, I support that or I don't. It is a delicate situation that happened here in town. I think there's people that think that's okay. It's in a private business. There's also people that don't agree with what happened, and then what do we do about it? Another piece of this is, what do we do with it within the legal system that we have? So passing a bill that's not going to get what I call traction, I'm not convinced is always the best thing to do. I guess it's kind of the equivalent of firing a cannonball across the bow of a ship. If it doesn't hit anything, was it helpful? So I think time will tell. Like a lot of those things, you can jump in and say, hey, we got to deal with this right away, or you know, maybe some time and some water under the bridge is going to get us to a better solution. And that's sometimes what it takes to get to there. So that's what I'm in a wait and see. I did some research when all that came about. I got a few emails. I made a number of phone calls. I talked to some people in Boise about it. I talked to some people locally that are involved. And I couldn't myself come up with a solution of, hey, Mark, draft this bill and fix this. I haven't not found anything that would what I call get traction. So that's the process. You know, I don't think that we should get in the business of writing bills that just are more of a statement than they are something that works. So anyway, we got to, I know we're going to wrap up here, but anyway, let me get a couple questions and then we got to go. You just get this gentleman over here.
Seems to me to be a bigger problem than just contacting your representatives or you know who you vote for. I guess I'm looking for, what do you think is really going on here? Maybe you don't agree with some of that, but you know, what is leading to all of this dissension and just dirty politics?
Trying to answer. Briefly, you can go a long time on that. Thanks. I think, you know, at least for me, I think my job, as I understand it, and I look at it all of you, my job is to represent our community. It is not to try and pit anyone in our community against anyone else. It's what's in the best interest of our community, and that sounds like a little bit of a holier-than-thou thing, but I don't want to go there. But what would our community like to see? You know, I think, you know, not to change the subject, but I think a better lake operation, I think we can all say, you know what, doggone it, that'd be a good thing. But many other issues, until we can come up with a solution that's going to work for our community, I think sometimes we have to sit and wait. Maybe we'd be active in the solution building, but I think we have a duty, at least I feel I have a duty to all of you to listen to you and see where we are as a community and how it works. And that's my Northern Light, is to, you know, what's good for our community and what's responsible and considerate. So, and to not go out of the lines and create animosity and play one side against, that's not, I hope I haven't done that. And I don't intend to. So I hope I answered your question briefly. So, yes, ma'am. That's not done very often, ma'am. just saying.
That's correct.
That's okay.
I mean, okay, that feels good for you, but can you say, like, 4-1, I hear from my constituents?
Oh. That... Sometimes, but the individual lobby from Sandpoint, I don't get a lot of emails from home. Okay, I welcome them. I look at them. That's why I asked, you know, can you put your zip code in the byline so I know it's not somebody that is maybe saying, you know, this really important message and turns out they're from Idaho Falls and they have some questions. It's like, ask the guys from Idaho Falls to answer your questions. You know, I need to focus on the voters that are here because that's who I represent. So, but have at it. If you, one way or the other, if you have a comment on what's going on, email me. I welcome all those. Thank you.
Mark, I think you have one last question.
Yes, ma'am.
How much contact do you have with younger people? Because most of us are older. And I want to thank you immensely for being here. And
you're welcome. I get out as much as I can. When I'm home, I go to the Panada, which, you know, yes, a lot of you are going to the Panada too. But I go out, I look, you know, Katie talked earlier, Katie Cox. I go to their event sometimes. You know, a year ago I gave out a bunch of pumpkins to a bunch of kids, which is really a memorable event. So I try and be out as much as I can. I have friends in my old neighborhood that have some kids that I interact with a little bit and just kind of know what's going on with them.
Jim get to talk to students at the high schools?
You know, we just had a group of students that I toured at the Capitol a couple weeks ago from a private school up in Sully Valley. And I jumped right in. I spent a couple hours with those kids. So yeah, whenever we get the chance, and then typically in spring, a number of the high school teachers have asked us to come in and talk to the local government class on how they can get, people can get involved and how important it is to vote. You know, I went to the Sandpoint School with the Lieutenant Governor, and we talked about the launch program and how kids could apply for that. So there's lots of ways to get involved, and for me, I just try and be around. That's really my strategy. But you're right. We do tend to, you know, see people with, you know, some nicks on them. Hi, Iris. Bye, guys. So. No, I didn't. Yeah. Sure. Sure. There's ITD asked about comments on their highway plans, and this nice lady up here has you can snap the QR code and get involved. But it would be very helpful for everyone to go to the ITD website and check it out and see and provide your feedback on it. Because a lot of times it's local issues that really satisfy problems. You know, the Texas turnaround that we have on Highway 95 south of Lakeshore, I think that in a way was kind of, it started out as kind of a local issue. Senator Woodward was really involved in that one. And there's other comments like, you know, what can we do to try and keep people from making U-turns and doing that, the left and the left or right and the left, whatever it is over at the Longhorn Saloon. But how we can keep people safe, because none of us want to have a problem on the highway. So, but sometimes those are just basic local issues, and, you know, it comes down to us providing feedback to people that are in Coeur d'Alene or in Boise that manage our highways. So that's important. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thank you.